tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We are moving on to part 21 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am Ted Midward. You are listening to RadioAryan.com. Before we move on, I do want to give a shout-out. If you guys aren't subscribed, if you have YouTube accounts, YouTube sign-ins, go subscribe to Gustav Johansson. He archives all these episodes and has great pro-white, white nationalist content. Go subscribe to his channel. He puts these up for Radio Aryan and myself every week. I certainly appreciate that. Thank you to him from me. Also, if you enjoy other audiobook type work readings, you can find out more of my content at tedmidward.info. That's MIDWARD.info. Okay, let's get into this week's segment. First off, we have an article about President Taft, and it's the title of this one is Taft Once Tried to Resist Jews and Failed. William Howard Taft is an amiable gentleman. There's so much to agree with in the world that he seldom finds it possible to disagree with anything. It is a very comfortable attitude for one to assume, but it doesn't push the world along. Real harmony is wrung out of discord by laboring against disagreeable facts. It is not achieved by mere pit-pats on the back of untoward conditions. There is no doubt that had one approached William Howard Taft a year ago and said, "Mr. Taft, you know, there are evil forces in the world which ought to be resisted," and he would have replied, "Certainly, by all means." If one had said, "Mr. Taft, some of this evil is just ignorant inclination which can be dealt with by various means of enlightenment, but some of it represents a deliberate philosophy which has gathered about itself a definite organization for action," and he would have responded back, "Oh, I'm afraid it's true." And then had one said to him, "Mr. Taft, the people should be made aware of this, given a key to it, that they may keep their eyes open and learn the meaning of certain tendencies that have puzzled them," he would in all likelihood have replied, "I believe in enlightening the public mind, that it may take care of itself." Suppose you added this to him, "Mr. Taft, if you found a written program setting forth the steps to be taken to fasten a certain control on society, and if on looking about you observed a definite set of tendencies which seemed to parallel the program at every point, would it appear to you to be significant?" Mr. Taft would, of course, answer, "Yes." There is no other answer to make. No other answer has been made by anyone who has compared the two things. If Mr. Taft had been approached first on that side of the question, he would have uttered words very valuable to those who would attach value to his words. But what has Mr. Taft's testimonial to do with either side of the case? Does his support strengthen it, or does his opposition weaken it? If it came to a battle of names, the Dearborn Independent could present a very imposing list of men who acknowledge the importance of the studies being made and who agree with most of the observations presented, but such a list would add nothing to the facts in the case. Facts must stand on their own foundation, regardless of the attitude of Mr. Taft or even Mr. Arthur Brisbane. But there's a very interesting story about Mr. Taft in the Jews. Mr. Taft knows it and can verify it. A number of American Jews also know it. And it may perhaps be useful to tell it now. However, that we may not seem too desirous of evading Mr. Taft's latest defense of the Jews, we shall begin with it. Unduly stirred by this series of studies, the leading Jews of the United States indicated by their perturbation that the truth in these articles made it impossible to ignore them. Perhaps as many people have been inclined toward agreement with the articles by the attitude of the Jews themselves as by the statements made in the articles. Jewish defense has been made with great formality and show of authority, but without the hoped-for effect. The Jews of the United States, evidently finding that their own statements have failed to carry, are making a wholesale conscription of Gentiles for the purpose of defense. As in Russia, the Gentiles are being pushed into the firing lines. Mr. Taft was therefore approached with the proposition. That was some time ago, probably about November 1st. Now, according to Mr. Taft's own signed statement made on November 1st, he had not even read the Dearborn Independence articles, but was taking the Jews' word for their character and contents. And yet, on December 23rd, we find Mr. Taft in Chicago at the LaSalle Hotel, delivering an oration before B'nai B'rith, uttering his statements with all the finality of a man who has made a deep study of the Jewish question and had at last attained a mature conclusion. On November 1st, Mr. Taft wrote to a New York Jew deprecating these articles as a foolish pronouncement, which I understand has been issued through the Dearborn Independent. The expression, which I understand, quote-unquote, is equivalent in ordinary speech to which I have heard. He had not read them. He was taking hearsay on which to base his opinion. There are signs that he had not read them even at the time of his speech in Chicago, for he did not so much as allude to one of the startling parallels which have weighed on the minds of many important men in this country. The Jews wanted Mr. Taft's name. They wanted a Gentile front, so to speak, and they got it. The speech contributes nothing to the discussion. It proves nothing. It disproves nothing. In parts, it is a rehash of a speech delivered by a New York rabbi. Indeed, one of William Howard Taft's most telling points was the almost verbal repetition of a point made by that rabbi. Mr. Taft's business now is the delivery of the addresses. Between November 1st, at which time he had not read the Jewish question at all, until December 23rd, when he presumed to pronounce judgment on it for all time, he had been away a great deal on the road. Indeed, he reached Chicago without having done any of his Christmas shopping. He explained that he had been traveling over the country so fast that all his time had been taken up. When he found time to study the Jewish question, when he found time to study, the Jewish question does not appear. It is most probable that he had no time and did no studying. If he did, he carefully concealed the fruits of it when delivering his address. Before his address was delivered, the newspapers had announced that it was to be made against anti-Semitism, and this series of articles was specified. It was apparently foreknown, therefore, that not a judicial pronouncement was to be expected from Mr. Taft, but a partisan plea. The newspapers indicate that Mr. Taft had not even dictated his speech until he reached Chicago. The material he had at hand during his dictation was the printed propaganda with which the Jews have been flooding the country. Taft's speech reeks with it. There isn't an original idea in it. He was the human megaphone whom the Jews retained for one night through whom to voice their words. The real purpose of the speech was, of course, to secure its publication throughout the country as the voice of the people on the Jewish question. But nothing whatever excuses the fact that the speech contains absolutely no contribution to the question. Mr. Taft is against religious prejudice. So is everybody else. Mr. Taft is against racial prejudice. So is everybody else. Mr. Taft wants concord and goodwill. So does everybody else. But what have these to do with the facts which comprise the Jewish question? The real story of Mr. Taft and the Jews begins back in the time when Mr. Taft lived in the White House. The Jews maintain a lobby in Washington whose business it is to know every president and every prospective president, and, of course, Mr. Taft was known to them a long while before he was made president. But whether they did not foresee his political future, or whether they considered his opinions as having too little force for them to bother about, is not clear. But the fact seems to be that very little fuss was made about him. There are no indications that he ran after the Jews or the Jews after him in the days before the presidency. As president, Mr. Taft once stood out against the Jews, which was strongly denounced as unfavorable to the Jews, and was soundly beaten by Jews in a matter on which he had taken a firm stand, and has ever since shown that he has learned his lesson by accommodating the Jews in their desires. The story involves a portion of that voluminous history which consists of the quarrels between the United States and other nations on account of the Jews. Readers interested in this phase of the history of the United States can find it fully set out by Jewish writers. There seems to be a certain pride taken in recounting the number of times the nations have been compelled to give diplomatic recognition to the Jewish question. From 1840 until 1911, the United States had special diplomatic trouble concerning the Jews. The trouble that culminated during 1911 in an unparalleled act by the United States involved William Howard Taft, who then was president. For centuries, Russia has had her own troubles with the Jews, and, as the world knows, has at last fallen prostrate before the Jewish power which, for centuries, has been working to undermine her. Even Benjamin Disraeli was not blinded to the fact that Jews had a control over Russia which the rest of the world never knew. The biggest hoax in modern times was the propaganda against Russia as a persecutor of the Jews. Russia devoted to the Jews a large part of the most favored section of the land, and was always so lax in those laws which prohibited Jews from settling in other parts of the country, that the Jew was able to create an underground system throughout the whole of Russia, which controlled the grain trade, controlled public opinion, and utterly baffled the Tsar's government. The cry of persecution arose because the Jews were not permitted to exploit the peasants as much as they desired. Are you listening out there? They have, however, gained that privilege since. Now, when the United States appeared as the New Jerusalem, its Jewish citizens conceived the idea of using the American government to achieve for the Jews what other means had failed to achieve. Russian and German Jews would come to the United States, become naturalized as quickly as possible, and go back to Russia as Americans to engage in trade. Russia knew them as Jews and held them to be subject to the laws relating to Jews. Protest after protest reached the State Department as more and more German and Russian Jews went back to Russia to circumvent the Russian laws. At first, the matter was not serious, because it was shown in many cases that these naturalized Americans, quote-unquote, did not intend to return to the United States at all, but had acquired American citizenship solely as a business asset in Russia. In these cases, of course, the United States did not feel obligated to bestir herself. The time came, however, when American ministers to Russia were requested to look into the situation. Their reports are accessible. John W. Foster was one of these ministers, and he reported in 1880 that, quote, Russia would be glad to give liberal treatment to bona fide American citizens, not disguised German Jews, end quote. During all this time, the Russian question was being sedulously propagated in the United States. It appeared first in the aspect of the Russian persecutions, quote-unquote. The Jews represented that their life in Russia was a hell. John W. Foster, later Secretary of State, father-in-law of Robert Lansing, the recently resigned Secretary of State under President Wilson, was at that time representing the United States in Russia, and he reported as follows on the status of Russian Jews. Here we go. In all the cities of Russia, the number of Jewish residents will be found more or less in excess of the police registry and greater than the strict interpretation of the law authorizes. For instance, persons who have given the subject close attention estimate the number of Jewish residents in St. Petersburg at 30,000, while it is stated the number registered by the police authorities is 1,500. From the same source, I learned that while only one Hebrew school is registered by the police, there are between 3 and 4,000 children in unauthorized Jewish schools of this capital. As another indication of the extent of Jewish influence, it is worthy of note that one or more Jewish editors or writers are said to be employed on the leading newspapers of St. Petersburg and Moscow, almost without exception. That is the end of the quote from John W. Foster. At every turn, the United States government discovered that the Jews were exaggerating their difficulties for the purpose of forcing government action. Presently, after years of underground work and open propaganda against Russia in the daily press, until the American conception of Russia was fixed almost beyond correction, the agitation took the form of the Russian passport question. Russia dares to flout an American passport. Russia insults the government of the United States. Russia degrades American citizens. So forth and so on. You get the idea. Jews in the United States demanded nothing less than that the United States break all treaty relations with Russia. They demanded it. James G. Blaine desired one thing more than another, which was this, that something, anything, be done to block the flood of Jewish immigration then beginning to flood the country. The hospitality of a nation should not be turned into a burden, he wrote. There was then the strange situation of the United States itself making complaints about the Jews and at the same time being asked to question Russia's right to handle similar complaints in her own domain. The Minister of Foreign Affairs for Russia appreciated this point, and when the American minister told him that 200,000 Jews had emigrated to the United States from Russia, he rejoined saying, "If such a number of people had gone to the United States as workers to aid in developing the country, he supposed they would be acceptable. But if they went to exploit the American people, he could understand how objectionable it was." Of course, the whole point with Russia was that the Jews were exploiting her. They were milking Russia, not feeding her. If space permitted, much rich material could be presented here. The attitude of the American statesmen of 25 to 40 years ago on questions of immigration and racial propaganda was eminently wise and sound. So, until the days of William Howard Taft, this Jewish propaganda continued, always aimed at Russia, always planning to use the United States as the club with which to strike the blow. It must be borne in mind at all times that the Jews maintain a lobby in Washington, a sort of embassy from the Jewish nation to the government of the United States, and this lobby is in the hands of a principal ambassador. It was, of course, this ambassador's business to get hold of President Taft as firmly as possible. But President Taft was not at that time so easy as the people have since been taught to regard him. There was a commercial treaty between Russia and the United States, and it had existed since 1832, and President Taft behaved as if he thought the Jewish demand that the treaty be broken was rather too much. The Jewish demand was that the United States denounce a treaty which had existed between the two countries for almost 80 years, and during the life of which Russia had repeatedly proved herself to be a reliable friend of this country. The Jews wanted two things from William Howard Taft: the abrogation of the Russian treaty and the veto of what Congress had repeatedly tried to do, namely putting a literacy test on immigrants. Jewish immigration to the United States being so important an element to Jewish plans, American Jews never cared what kind of human riffraff filled the country as long as the Jewish flood was not hindered. Presently, President Taft has undergone the persistent nagging characteristic of such campaigns and had asked, perhaps impatiently, what they wanted him to do. "Have a conference with some of the leaders of American Jewry," was the proposal made to him, and on February 15, 1911, there walked into the White House Jacob H. Schiff, Jacob Firth, Louis Marshall, Adolph Krauss, and Judge Henry M. Goldfogel. They had lunch with the president's family and adjourned to the library. Let me stop here for a second. I'm pretty sure Jacob H. Schiff is the same Jacob Schiff, maybe I'm wrong, that financed Lenin and Trotsky taking over Russia, according to conspiracy history. It was Jacob Schiff's gold and him and his connections in Germany putting Lenin in a sealed train car that got him into Russia to take over. Anyways, continuing on with the text. "The president was fairly wise in this matter. There was no chance whatever for him in an argument. His guests had come prepared to talk, to tell him, quote unquote, as some of the same men lately told an Eastern publisher, pounding the table and uttering threats. The president was to be overwhelmed, his good nature carried with a rush. But instead of anything like that, the president, as soon as they gathered in the library, took out a paper and began to read his conclusions. That staggered the Jewish ambassadors at once. The president was reading his conclusions. He was telling them. The president's statement is really worth reading, but it's far too lengthy to present here. He called attention to the right which this country exercised to say who shall and who shall not sojourn here, and also to the conflicting interpretations which American secretaries of state had given the Russian treaty. He contrasted with that Russia's consistent interpretation from the beginning. He then said that the treaty was sacred because under it, for more than 50 years, the citizens of the United States had made their investments in Russia, resting solely on their faith in the United States and Russia's treaty honor. He said that if it were a new treaty that was being written, the case would be different. He would then consider the Jewish argument of weight. But, he said, we had other treaties with other countries who did not always share our views as to what certain sections of the treaties meant, but we have lived and worked under them. He instanced the Italian treaty with regard to the extradition of criminals. He wished to impress on the Jewish ambassadors that they wanted to make an exception of their case, which, of course, they did. The president then said he would be willing to consider taking some action if he did not believe that in taking action he would be endangering the status the Jews already enjoyed in Russia. If this treaty were denounced, large American interests would be jeopardized. And at this point of the conversation, the president mentioned certain interests, which happened to be all Gentile. He said he liked to see Russian Jews come into the country, but added, the more we spread them out in the West, the better I like it. He ended with a plea for the Jewish ambassadors there to present, he ended with a plea for the Jewish ambassadors there present to consider the plight which denunciation of the treaty might involve Russian Jews, and ended with the words, "That is the way it has struck me, gentlemen. That is the conclusion I have reached." The Jewish group was plainly taken aback. Simon Wolfe, who was always on guard at Washington, said, "Please, Mr. President, do not give to the press such conclusions." But Jacob Schiff broke in with a vibrant voice with anger, "I want it published! I want the whole world to know the president's attitude." The discussion then opened, with the president cool and self-contained. Finally, after some useless talk and having other business to attend to, he gave them a letter just received from the American ambassador at St. Petersburg, a Mr. Rockhill. Mr. Rockhill presented in that letter to the president the whole Russian contention about the Jews, statements which have been confirmed 1,000 times by the events that have occurred since. They then renewed their expostulations and arguments, but to no avail. The president expressed regret, but said he could see no other course to pursue. He had studied the question in all its lights, and his conclusion was as stated. On leaving the White House, Jacob Schiff refused to shake the president's hand, but brushed it by with an air of offended power. "Wasn't Mr. Schiff angry yesterday?" exclaimed the president the very next day. But the president did not know what was going on. When Jacob Schiff was descending the White House steps, he said, "This means war." He gave orders to draw on him for a large sum of money. He wrote a curt letter to President Taft. The president sent Mr. Schiff's letter and the reply to the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, Charles Nagel, who replied to the president with these words, "I am very much impressed with the patience which you exhibit in your answer." Neither did the president know what was behind it all. Look at most of the names of the men who represented American Jewry in the White House that 15th of February, 1911, and then consider that the abrogation of the Russian treaty would throw all the vast business between the U.S. and Russia into Germany, into the hands of German Jews. The Frankfurt bankers and their relatives in the United States knew what that meant. It meant that German Jews would be the intermediaries of trade between Russia and the United States. The business itself meant money, but the relation meant power over Russia, and Jacob H. Schiff lived to overthrow Russia. The neutrality of the United States was torn to shreds by a movement organized and financed on American soil for the overthrow of a friendly nation, and the organizers and financiers were, you guessed it, Jews. They used their internal power to deflect the policy of the United States to assist their plans. Let me just stop here. This is coming to mind, and now that I'm reading this, Jacob H. Schiff, for those who don't know out there, Jacob H. Schiff was almost like an adopted son of the Rothschild banking dynasty. He grew up in a Rothschild home and was brought up more or less as one of them. So you see the name Schiff, and yes, it's Jewish, but Jacob Schiff in particular is like August Belmont, who was a character during the Civil War, who was a financier and was taken in by the Rothschilds as a child or a teenager and was more or less an apprentice, I guess that would be the correct term. Anyways, look into Jacob Schiff. It's a sad story about the Bolshevik Jewish takeover of Russia, but of course it is interesting to see the connections to capitalist financiers like Jacob Schiff, who organized and funded the whole thing. Okay, let me get back to the text before I get too far off base. Back to the text. The game was financial and revolutionary. It was decreed. It was then part of the program to be accomplished, and the United States was to be used as the crowbar to batter down the walls. When the Jewish ambassadors left the White House, orders flew from Washington and New York to every part of the U.S., and the Jewish nagging drive began. It had a center in every city. It was focused on every representative and senator. No official, however, was too mean or unimportant to be drafted. American editors may remember that drive. It was operated on precisely the same lines as the one which is proceeding against the press today. The Jews have furnished absolute proof in the last 2 months that they control the majority of the American press. There are signs, however, that their control does not mean anything and will not last long. Jacob Schiff had said on February 15th, "This means war." He had ordered a large sum of money used for that purpose. The American Jewish Committee, B'nai B'rith, and other of the numerous organizations of Jewry went to work, and on December 13th of that same year, almost 10 months to a day after Jewry had declared war on President Taft's conclusions, both houses of Congress ordered President Taft to notify Russia that the treaty with Russia would be terminated. Frankfurt on the Main had won. In the meantime, of course, the Jewish press of the United States berated President Taft with characteristic Jewish unreserve. It would be an eye-opener if, at every speech which William Howard Taft makes for his Jewish clients, there could be distributed copies of the remarks printed about President Taft by those same clients 9 years ago. The methods, by which the Jews set forth to force congressional action are all known, and the glee with which Jewry hailed the event is also known. Two governments had been beaten, the American and the Russian, and the American president had been reversed. Whether this had anything to do with the fact that William Howard Taft became that unusual figure, a one-term president, this chronicle does not undertake to say. There was quite a scurry for cover at that time. Taft had been beaten, and all the men who had stood beside him ran in out of the storm. Taft had been beaten, and all the men who had stood beside him ran in out of the storm. John Hayes Hammond was represented as having been sympathetic with the Russian view of the Jews, as most of the American representatives were. As late as 1917, William Howard Taft, then a private citizen, wrote to the principal Jewish lobbyist in Washington asking that Mr. Hammond be not held up in Jewish histories as one who had opposed the breaking of the Russian treaty. The president had really done what he could to prevent the Jewish plan going through. On February 15th, 1911, he withstood them face to face. On December 13th, 1911, they had whipped him. And yet, in the next year, 1912, a peculiar thing occurred. The high officials of the B'nai B'rith went to the White House, and there pinned on the breast of the President Taft a medal which marked him as, quote, "the man who had contributed most during the year to the welfare of the Jewish cause," end quote. There's a photograph extant of President Taft standing on the fourth portico of the White House in the midst of a group of prominent Jews, and the president is wearing his medal. He's not smiling. But even after that, the Jews were not sure of President Taft. There was a fear expressed by private letters between prominent Jews, and also in the Jewish press, that President Taft, while officially abrogating the treaty, would consent to some working agreement which would amount to about the same thing. There were cables from Jews in Russia stating that Taft would do that. The president was closely watched. Whenever there was an open chink in his daily program, he was approached on the matter. It was made utterly impossible for him to do anything to patch up the differences. Frankfurt was to have the handling of American trade with Russia, and Jewry was to have that club over Russia. Money, more and more money, always accompanies every Jewish plan for racial or political power. They make the world pay them for subjugating it. And their first cinch hold on Russia they won in the United States. The end of that American influence was the rise of Bolshevism, the destruction of Russia, and the murder of Nicholas Romanov and his family. This is the story of William Howard Taft's efforts to withstand the Jews and how they broke him. It's probably worth knowing in view of the fact that he has become one of those Gentile fronts which the Jews use for their own defense. that is the end of this article, which is, of course, the first half of our presentation. This was published in the Dearborn Independent on January 15th, 1921. Oh, let me just mention, since I'm in between sections here and we have a moment to address, I am a fan of gangster, mob movies, mob shows, that kind of thing. And I just started watching, I'm like probably a decade late on this, I know, go ahead and laugh, but I just started watching Boardwalk Empire. And in it, in one of the first few episodes, the main character, Nucky Thompson, who's this Atlantic City gangster who controls the city, he has an issue with Arnold Rothstein. Arnold Rothstein was a Jewish gangster in the early 20th century who actually fixed the 1919 World Series and got one of the White Sox players to throw the game, and many people don't know that, right? Anyways, in that, in one of these episodes, Nucky Thompson, who's played by Steve Buscemi, goes to one of his contacts or friends and tells him that he has a problem with a Jewish person, referring to Arnold Rothstein. And this character, they happen to be in this man's study with a fireplace, and he pulls out a book and hands it to Nucky and says, "This ought to help you," something to that effect. And the camera shows the book, and it's none other than Henry Ford's The International Jew. I thought it was interesting. I don't know how accurate the rest of the series is. I think they try to stay close to the historicity of what really happened then, but I just thought it was worth mentioning if you like that kind of thing. Maybe Boardwalk Empire would be a good thing to watch if you want to continue learning about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Anyways, just to wrap up with that thought, they show Henry Ford's International book. The one character hands it to Steve Buscemi's character, and Steve Buscemi declines the book, saying that, well, my problem isn't with world financiers, it's actually with underworld vice and gambling and gangster character, which, of course, he's referring to Arnold Rothstein. Okay, enough of my anecdotes and storytelling. Let's move on to the second half here of part 21. This article is entitled, When Editors Were Independent of the Jews. The first instinctive answer which the Jew makes to any criticism of his race, coming from a non-Jew, is that of violence, threatened or inflicted. This statement will be confirmed by hundreds of thousands of citizens of the U.S. who have heard the evidence with their own ears. Of recent months, the country has been full of threats against persons who have taken cognizance of the Jewish question, threats which have been spoken, whispered, written, and passed as resolutions by Jewish organizations. If the candid investigator of the Jewish question happens to be in business, then boycott is the first answer of which the Jews seem to think. Whether it be a newspaper, as in the case of the old New York Herald, or a mercantile establishment, as in the case of A.T. Stewart's famous store, or a hotel, as in the case of the old Grand Union Hotel at Saratoga, or a dramatic production, as in the case of The Merchant of Venice, or any manufactured article whose maker has adopted the policy that my goods are for sale but my principles are not, if there is any manner of business connection with the student of the Jewish question, the first answer is always boycott. The technique is this. A whispering drive is first begun. Disquieting rumors began to fly thick and fast. Watch us get 'em is the word that's passed along. Jews in charge of ticker news services adopt the slogan of a rumor a day. Jews in charge of local newspapers adopt the policy of a slurring headline a day. Jews in charge of the newsboys on the streets give orders to emphasize certain news in the street cries. A new yell against him every day, they say. The whole campaign against the critic of Jewry, whoever he may be, is keyed to the threat. Watch us get him. Just as Mr. Gompers and Justice Brandeis believe in the secondary strike, as a recent Supreme Court decision reveals, so the Jews who set out to punish the students of the Jewish question believe in a secondary boycott. Not only do they pledge themselves not to use the specific product in question, but they pledge themselves to boycott anyone else who uses it. If the article is a hat, not only do the Jews pledge themselves to refrain from buying that kind of hat, but also to refrain from doing business with anyone who wears such a hat. And then, when anything seems to occur at the hat which works, I'm sorry, let me start over. And then, when anything seems to occur at the hat works indicates slackness, the Jews, forgetting all about their denial of a pledged boycott, begin to boast, "See what we did to him? The whispering drive, the boycott, these are the chief Jewish answers. They constitute the bone, the carrot in the stick, of that state of mind in non-Jews which is known as the fear of the Jews." They do not always notify their victim. Recently, the young sales manager of a large wholesale firm spoke at a dinner whose guests were mostly the firm's customers. He's one of those young men who have caught the vision of a new honor in business. He believes that the right thing is always practical, and other things being equal, profitable as well. Among the guests were probably 40 Jewish merchants, all customers of the firm. In his address, the young sales agent expressed his enthusiasm for morality by saying, "What we need in business is more of the principles of Jesus Christ." Now, as a matter of fact, the young man knows very little about Jesus Christ. He has caught fire from the Roger Babson idea of religious principle as a basis of business, but he expressed it in his own way, and everybody knew what he meant. He meant decency, not sectarianism. Yet, because he used the expression which he did, he lost 40 Jewish customers for his firm, and he doesn't yet know the reason why. The agents of the firm which got the new trade know the reason. It was a silent, unannounced boycott. This article is the story of a boycott which lasted over a number of years. It is only one of numerous stories of the same kind which can be told of New York. It concerns the New York Herald, one newspaper that dared to remain independent of Jewish influence in the metropolis. The Herald enjoyed an existence of 90 years, which was terminated about a year ago by an amalgamation. It performed great feats in the world of news gathering. It sent Henry M. Stanley to Africa to find Livingstone. It backed up the Jeannette expedition to the Arctic regions. It was largely instrumental in having the first Atlantic cables laid. But perhaps its greatest feat was the maintenance during many years of its journalistic independence against the combined attack of New York Jewry. Its reputation among newspaper men was that neither its news nor its editorial columns could be bought or influenced. Its proprietor, the late James Gordon Bennett, had always maintained a friendly attitude toward the Jews of his city. He apparently harbored no prejudice against them. Certainly, he never deliberately antagonized them, but he was resolved upon preserving the honor of independent journalism. He never bent to the policy that the advertisers had something to say about the editorial policy of the paper, either as to influencing it for publication or suppression. 30 years ago, the New York press was free. Today, it's practically all Jewish-controlled. The control is variously exercised, sometimes resting only on the owner's sense of expediency. But the control is there, and, for the moment, it's absolute. One does not have to go far to be able to find the controlling factor in any case. Newspaper men do not glory in the fact, however. It is a condition, not a crusade, that confronts them, and for the moment, business is business. 30 years ago, there were also more newspapers in New York than there are today. There were 8 or 9 morning newspapers. There are only 5 today. The Herald, which was a 3-cent newspaper, enjoyed the highest prestige and was the most desirable advertising medium due to the class of its circulation. It easily led the journalistic field. At that time, the Jewish population of New York was less than 1/3 of what it is today, but there was much wealth represented in it. Now, what every newspaperman knows is this. Most Jewish leaders are always interested either in getting a story published or getting it suppressed. There is no class of people who read the public press so carefully, with an eye to their own affairs, as do the Jews, and many an editor can vouch for that. The Herald simply adopted the policy from the beginning of this form of harassment that it was not to be permitted to sway the Herald from its duty as a public informant, and that this had a reflex advantage for the other newspapers is apparent from the following statement. If a scandal occurred in Jewish circles, influential Jews would swarm into the editorial offices to arrange for a suppression of the story. But the editors knew that not far away was the Herald, which would not suppress for anything or anybody. What was the use of one paper suppressing if another wouldn't? So the editors would say, "We would be very glad to suppress this story, but the Herald is going to run it, so we'll have to do the same in self-protection. However, if you can get the Herald to suppress it, we will gladly do so, too." But the Herald never succumbed. Neither pressure of influence, nor promises of business, nor threats of loss availed. It simply printed the news. There was a certain Jewish banker who periodically demanded that Bennett discharge the Herald's financial editor. This banker was in the business of disposing of Mexican bonds at a time when such bonds were least secure. Once, when an unusually large number of bonds were to be unloaded on unsuspecting Americans, the Herald published the story of an impending Mexican revolution, which presently ensued. The banker frothed at the mouth and moved every influence he could to change the Herald's financial staff, but was not able to effect the change even of an office boy. Once, when a shocking scandal involved a member of a prominent family, Bennett refused to suppress it, arguing that if the episode had occurred in a family of any other race, it would be published regardless of the prominence of the figures involved. The Jews of Philadelphia secured suppression there, but because of Bennett's unflinching stand, there was no suppression in New York. A newspaper is a business proposition. There are some matters it cannot touch without putting itself in peril of becoming a defunct concern. This is especially true since newspapers no longer receive their support from the public, but from the advertisers. The money the reader gives for the paper scarcely suffices to pay for the amount of white paper he receives. In this way, advertisers cannot be disregarded any more than the paper mills can be. And as the most extensive advertisers are the department stores, and as most department stores are owned by Jews, it comes logically that Jews often try to influence the news policies, at least, of the papers with whom they deal. In New York, it has always been the burning ambition of the Jews to elect a Jewish mayor. They selected a time when the leading parties were disrupted to push forward their choice. The method which they adopted was characteristic. They reasoned that the newspapers would not dare to refuse the dictum of the combined department store owners, so they drew up a strictly confidential letter, which they sent to the owners of the New York newspapers, demanding support for the Jewish mayoral candidate. The newspaper owners were in a quandary. For several days, they debated how to act. All remained silent. The editors of the Herald cabled the news to Bennett, who was abroad. Then it was that Bennett exhibited the boldness and directness of judgment which characterized him. He cabled back, "Print the letter." It was printed in the Herald's editorial columns. The arrogance of the Jewish advertisers was exposed, and non-Jewish New York breathed easier and applauded the action. The Herald explained frankly that it could not support a candidate of private interests because it was devoted to the interests of the public. But the Jewish leaders vowed vengeance against the Herald and against the man who dared expose their game. They had not liked Bennett for a long time anyway. The Herald was the real society newspaper in New York, but Bennett had a rule that only the names of really prominent families should be printed. The stories of the efforts of newly rich Jews to break into the Herald's society columns are some of the best that are told by old newspapermen, but Bennett was obdurate. Sorry. His policy stood. Bennett, however, was shrewd enough not to invite open conflict with the Jews. He felt no prejudice against the race. He simply resented their efforts to intimidate him. The whole matter culminated in a contention which began between Bennett and Nathan Strauss, a German Jew whose business house is known under the name of R.H. Macy and Company. Macy being the Scotchman who built up the business and from whose heirs Strauss obtained it. Mr. Strauss was something of a philanthropist in the ghetto, but the story goes that Bennett's failure to proclaim him as a philanthropist led to ill feeling between the two. A long newspaper war ensured, the subject of which was the value of the pasteurization of milk, a stupid discussion which no one took seriously, save Bennett and Strauss. The Jews, of course, took Mr. Strauss's side. Jewish speakers made the welkin ring with laudation of Nathan Strauss and maledictions upon James Gordon Bennett. Bennett was pictured in the most vile business of persecuting a noble Jew. It went so far that the Jews were able to put resolutions through the Board of Aldermen. Long since, of course, Strauss, a very heavy advertiser, had withdrawn every dollar's worth of his business from the Herald and the Evening Telegram, and now the combined powerful elements of New York Jewry gathered together to deal a staggering blow at Bennett, as years before they had dealt a blow to another citizen of New York. The Jewish policy of dominate or destroy was at stake, and Jewry declared war. As one man, the Jewish advertisers withdrew their advertisements from Mr. Bennett's newspapers. Their assigned reason was that the Herald was showing animosity against the Jews. The real purpose of their action was to crush an American newspaper owner who dared be independent of them. The blow they delivered was a staggering one. It meant the loss of $600,000 a year. Any other newspaper in New York would have been put out of business by it. The Jews knew that and sat back, waiting for the downfall of the man they chose to consider their enemy. But Bennett was ever a fighter. Besides, he knew Jewish psychology probably better than any other non-Jew in New York. He turned the tables on his opponents in a startling and unexpected fashion. The coveted positions in his papers had always been used by the Jews. These he immediately turned over to non-Jewish merchants under exclusive contracts, merchants who had been formerly crowded into the back pages and obscure corners by the more opulent Jewish advertisers, now blossomed forth full page in the most popular spaces. One of the non-Jewish merchants who took advantage of the new situation was John Wanamaker, whose largest advertisements from that time forward were conspicuous in the Bennett newspapers. The Bennett papers came out with undiminished circulation in full advertising pages. The well-planned catastrophe did not occur. Instead, there was a rather comical surprise. Here were the non-Jewish merchants of New York enjoying the choicest service of a valuable advertising medium, while the Jewish merchants were unrepresented. Besides, the punishment that the Jews had administered showed no signs of inflicting inconvenience, let alone even pain. The boycott had been hardest on the boycotters. Unable to stand the spectacle of trade being diverted to non-Jewish merchants, the Jews dropped their hostile attitude and came back to Bennett, requesting the use of his columns for advertising. Bennett received all who came, displaying no rancor. They wanted back their old positions, but Bennett said no. They argued, but Bennett said no. They offered money, but Bennett said no. The choice positions had been forfeited. I love it. Then a curious circumstance transpired. A few Jews, whose business sense had overcome their racial passions, had continued to advertise in the Herald all through the boycott. When they saw their rebellious brethren coming back and taking what positions they could get in the advertising pages, they suspected that Bennett had lured them back by offering a lower rate. So they wrote to Bennett, demanding to know the circumstances, and as usual, Bennett published the letter and replied that his rates had not been lowered. Bennett had triumphed here, but it proved a costly victory. The Jews persistently followed the plan which they had inaugurated as early as 1877 for the ruin of another New Yorker who had refused to bow before them. All the time, Bennett was fighting them. The Jews were gradually growing more powerful in New York. They were growing more powerful in journalism every year. They were obsessed by the fatuous idea that to control journalism in New York meant to control the thought of the country. They regarded New York as the metropolis of the United States, whereas all balanced minds regard it as a disease. The number of newspapers gradually diminished through combinations of publications. Adolph S. Oakes, a Philadelphia Jew, acquired the Times. He soon made it into a great newspaper, but one whose bias is to serve the Jews. A tabulation of the Jewish publicity that finds its way into the Times reveals interesting figures. Of course, it is the quality of the Times as a newspaper that makes it so weighty as a Jewish organ. In this paper, the Jews are persistently lauded and eulogized and defended. No such tenderness is granted other races. It is quite possible that the staff of the Times will not regard this as entirely true. Personally and individually, the majority of them are not that kind of people. But there is the Times itself as evidence. And then Hearst came into the field, a dangerous agitator because he not only agitates the wrong things, but because he agitates the wrong class of people. He surrounded himself with a coterie of Jews, pandered to them, worked hand in glove with them, and even fell out with them, but never told the truth about them. Never gave them away, as they say. Naturally, he received a large advertising patronage. The trend toward the Jewish-controlled press set in strongly, and has continued that way ever since. The old names, made great by great editors and American policies, slowly dimmed over time. A newspaper is founded either on a great editorial mind, in which event it becomes the expression of a powerful personality, or it becomes institutionalized as to policy and becomes a commercial establishment. In the latter event, its chances for a continuing life beyond the lifetime of its founder are much stronger. The Herald was Bennett. As with his passing, it was inevitable that a certain force and virtue should depart out of it. Bennett, advancing in age, dreaded lest his newspaper, on his death, should fall into the hands of the Jews. He knew that they regarded it with longing eyes. He knew that they had pulled down, seized, and afterward built up many an agency that had dared speak the truth about him, about them, and boasted about it as a conquest for Jewry. A vindication of the oft misquoted prophecy, "He that curses you, I will curse." Bennett loved the Herald as a man loves his child. He so arranged his will that the Herald should never fall into individual ownership. He devised that its revenues should flow into a fund for the benefit of the men who worked to make the Herald what it was. He died in May 1918. The Jewish enemies of the Herald, eagerly watchful, more and more withdrew their advertising to force, if possible, the sale of the paper. They knew that if the Herald became a losing proposition, the trustees would have no course but to sell it, notwithstanding Mr. Bennett's will. But there was also strong moneyed interests in New York who were beginning to realize the peril of a Jewish press. These interests provided a large sum of money for the Herald's purchase by Frank A. Muncy. Then, to the general astonishment, Mr. Muncy discontinued the gallant old sheet and bestowed its name as part of the name of the New York Sun. But the actual newspaper managed by Bennett is extinct. Even the men who worked upon it are scattered abroad in the newspaper field. Even though the Jews had not gained possession of the coveted Herald, they had at least succeeded in driving another non-Jewish newspaper from the field. They set about obtaining control of several evening newspapers, which action is now complete. But the victory was a financial victory over a dead man. The moral victory, as well as the financial victory, remained with Bennett as long as he lived. The moral victory still remains with the Herald. The Herald is immortalized as the last bulwark against Jewry in New York. Today, the Jews are more completely masters of the journalistic field in New York than they are in any capital in Europe. Indeed, in every capital in Europe, there's a newspaper that gives the real news of the Jews. There is none in New York. And thus, the situation will remain until Americans shake themselves from their long sleep and look with steady eyes at the national situation. That look will be enough to show them all, and their very eyes will quail, the Oriental usurpers. The moral is this: whatever comes out of New York now must be doubly scrutinized, because it comes from the center of that Jewish government which desires to guide and color the thoughts of the people of the United States. That's the end of that article. This was issued, this was published on February 5th, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. Wow, let me just say, that was quite a segment. That was quite an article, both of them. I found them both very intriguing. I had never heard a lot of this information before, not about Bennett and the Herald, and I certainly did not know about President William Howard Taft and how he rebuffed the Jews. This was great. I really enjoyed this. I hope you guys enjoyed it too. You could probably tell I was a little bit more enthusiastic about reading it. I didn't find this as dry as some of the previous episodes. And like I said, if you want some homework, Jacob Schiff and the Rothschilds, Jacob Schiff and the Bolshevik Revolution. I'm sure all you guys know that. You guys, as an audience, are great. Very well educated. I hope you guys spread this around. Once again, I want to thank Sven Longshanks at Radio Aryan for publishing these for me. I also want to thank Gustav Johansson on YouTube. And if you like similar content, please check out tedmidward.info. Until next time, guys. Praise Christ. Take care. Bye-bye.